The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly and I'm Tom Clark. Another week, another series of astounding developments that have rocked the British establishment. We'll pick through the wreckage as the complacent coziness between press, politicians and policemen is blown apart. And as the Prime Minister struggles to stay ahead of the story, Ed Miliband looks to capitalise. We're joined by Prospect's political editor, James McIntyre, who's also one of the world's leading edologists. Beside him is The Guardian's Anne Perkins, and down the line is our columnist Michael White. A warm welcome to you all. Well, from Downing Street to Scotland Yard, from Wapping to Whitehall, this has been a week of recriminations. After 168 years, the last ever edition of the News of the World rolled off the presses at the weekend. Then on Monday, as new allegations surfaced, drawing in the former Prime Minister Gordon Brown and his family, David Cameron left it to his hapless Culture Secretary Jeremy Hunt to fend off an angry House of Commons. And Ed Miliband was quick to cash in.
Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister was wrong not to come to the House of Commons today. As on every occasion during this crisis, he has failed to show the necessary leadership the country expects. He saw no need for a judicial inquiry. He saw no need to change course on B Sky B, and he has failed to come clean on Andy Coulson. This is a Prime Minister running scared.
Next came the flame grilling of several top Metropolitan Police officers at the Home Affairs Select Committee. Assistant Commissioner John Yates, who bungled the initial investigation, revealed he himself had been hacked.
It has been suggested to me that it might... Not in the current investigation.
No, Operation Wheating.
Not in Operation Wheating, although that is...
But what about Operation Yates?
Operation...
Which lasted a day.
Touché. I'm.
So who told you this? That you
I'm being certain. From the methods I know that are used and the impact that has on your phone and your PIN number, I am 99% certain my phone was hacked during a period of actually 2005-6.
And then moments before it was all due to be debated in the House of Commons, Rupert Murdoch withdrew the News Corp bid for B Sky B. In the words of our front page today, he called the whole thing off. Now, Michael White, you've seen a lot of weeks in politics, but was this one week you never thought you'd see?
Well, I think the tottering Murdoch throne was something I didn't think Rupert would live to see, and possibly not me either, though he's 15 years older than me. He's been a remarkable buccaneer, and he's usually ahead of the curve. In the Financial Times today, no less a figure than Conrad Black, former editor of The Telegraph, went to jail, still protests his innocence, says he was stitched up. He feels a bit the same way about Murdoch, but he says that he's a great bad man, what somebody said of Oliver Cromwell and somebody else said of Napoleon, and that he's brilliant, but I quote some of the adjectives here. He has difficulty keeping friendship. He rarely keeps his word for long, is an exploiter of the discomfort of others, and has betrayed every political leader who ever helped him, except Ronald Reagan and perhaps Tony Blair. He's forgotten Margaret Thatcher there, of course, but Conrad Black's a bit out of practice on the typewriter. An extraordinary figure, Murdoch, and, you know, I won't believe it's all over until he is, as the old saying goes, buried with a stake in his heart at the crossroads at midnight, because he's a remarkable man. If he's Napoleon, is he on Elba or St. Helena? We think he's on St. Helena, but I'm still keeping my powder dry and keeping an army of 400,000 in the field, which is what the Allies failed to do in 1813.
If only the British had had you as commanding the troops at that time, Mike. I mean, well, such is the greatness of this bad man that it can now feel like no corner of the establishment is safe. And in the last few days, I think the penny's dropped with David Cameron that includes him too. At Prime Minister's questions, he jettisoned his normal generalities and went for a rather specific statement about what The Guardian had told his people and when.
Let me deal directly about the information given to my office by figures from The Guardian newspaper in February last year. First of all, this information was not passed on to me, but let me be clear. This was not some secret stash of information. Almost all of it was published in The Guardian Guardian in February 2010, at the same time my office was approached. It contained no allegations directly linking Andy Coulson to illegal behaviour. It didn't shed any further light on the issue of phone hacking, so it wasn't drawn to my attention by my office. And what's more, Mr. Speaker, what's more, let me just make this point. I met the editor of The Guardian the very next month, and he didn't raise it with me once. I met him a year later, he didn't raise it then either. Indeed, I would ask, if this information is so significant, why have I not been asked one question about it at a press conference or in this House?
And you're shaking your head in despairing. I've got to ask you why.
Well, I just the shunting of blame. I mean, quite extraordinary. You know, why did nobody bring me this crucial piece of information?
I think one point there, it sounded like he was saying, and nobody told my mum. I don't quite know what he meant by that. James, the really striking thing I thought about Cameron on Wednesday was that Andy Coulson, who he was talking about as a friend on Friday, he now adopted a very different tone about.
Yeah, he seems at last to have realised that Andy Coulson could be a serious problem for him. He said that it would be a matter for great regret if Coulson had proved to have lied, used that word. And I think that just in the last day or two, Cameron has suddenly realised, partly forced by Ed Miliband, that he has to get on the side of public opinion, both on Andy Coulson and more broadly on Murdoch. But he's angry. He's angry because the decline of the Murdoch empire is bad news for the Tory party, because its instincts are to back conservative forces in this country. And so he's got this one wrong, and he has finally realised that.
I think this has been a really defining moment for Cameron, and I think people, you know, will look back and say this is the moment when he, you know, confirmed his weaknesses. I mean, I have to say, I can't imagine a bigger challenge in the context of the current political culture for any political leader to face. Because, he goes off to Afghanistan last weekend, nearly a fortnight ago, and with things looking like one, things set in one way, and he comes back 48 hours later, and the whole world has shifted. And in the ensuing week, every landmark by which he has calibrated policy and communication has toppled and fallen. And so I do think it's an enormous challenge, but it's one that I think he's been really slow to understand.
Mike, are we a bunch of journalists getting overexcited about journalism?
Yeah, there's always an element of that. You beat me to the punch there, Tom. There is a bigger challenge coming up through the Channel Tunnel, which is the euro crisis, which will make this look
different nature.
Yeah, okay,
challenge.
But it's so much bigger, and you have to bear that in mind all the time. This is crazy that we're completely dominating the front pages when dreadful things are happening in the eurozone, which affect us all. Right, I've got that out of the way. No, Cameron has been slow on this. Standing by your man, there's an aspect of generosity about that. He was my friend, he is my friend, he said on Friday. And you have to acknowledge that. You're right, he's distanced himself. But we better, just bear in mind, Coulson hasn't said much. Coulson says, he's not guilty as charged. I could say a lot, he said when he appeared with Inspector Nacker the other day, but I can't. And we have to bear in mind that, maybe he was excluded from the plot. I find it hard to believe. Maybe he was excluded on purpose at the News of the World. You've got to, as Cameron said, people are innocent until proved guilty. It's a very healthy and proper instinct. And bear in mind, this is a disaster for the Murdochs. They've covered up, or their senior executives have covered up, considerable act of illegality, systemic, and maybe guilty, some of them, of conspiracy to obstruct the course of justice, which is more serious. But we don't know for sure yet. We've only got the outlines. And, caution and perspective is always, I know it's boring, but it's always worth hanging on to.
Very proper. And one thing that we've learnt this week is that the police didn't use their full army of powers when it came to the Murdochs. Parliament is now scrambling around in its rule book to try and find out what powers it does or doesn't have to compel Rebecca Brooks and the Murdochs to attend.
Well, the elected bits of Parliament have a very short memory. Select committees have actually very extensive powers, and they're certainly capable of requiring anyone in this country to turn up and give evidence. I mean, yep. Mike will remember the miners' strike and getting. Do you remember Mike Ian McGregor being escorted to through the St. Stephen's entrance to make sure he showed up?
How could we forget? This is the good side of the story, the growing powers of select committees. Several of them are really flexing their muscles now. They've got independent chairman elected by all the MPs, not by the whips, and Tyree at Treasury, Dorrell at Health, and now we've got a chance for Keith Vaz, a somewhat shop-soiled and improbable figure in many ways, got a real chance to do well. And I thought they put the coppers through the ringer this week and wasn't sorry to see it. I too have a memory long enough to remember when John Yates was hounding Tony Blair for 18 months. It didn't take 8 hours. It took 18 months for him to discover what I could have told him on day one, that they wouldn't find enough evidence to prosecute anybody over cash for honours. He made a meal of it. And I have to point out, a very anti-Blair mood at The Guardian. A lot of the colleagues were very much on John Yates' side then. Well, they're not so keen on him now.
James, are you heartened by, party politics aside, just the reassertion of parliamentary power that we seem to be on the cusp of seeing?
Yes, absolutely. And I have to say a word for John Bercow, the Speaker as well, who I think has been very strong in taking this seriously and shutting up some of the more lively Tory MPs particularly. But I'm also very heartened by the fact that the police may at last face some scrutiny and accountability that for decades, a bit like the Murdoch Empire, they have not faced any spotlight. And actually, Andy Heyman, talking of past links to other cases, was one of the people who helped cover up the John Charles de Menezes case, for which no one has been held accountable. So that's a delightful thing to see as well.
And he was really shocking in front of the committee, wasn't he? When every suggestion was, how dare you? It was kind of
completely sort of defensive, and like all slightly guilty men, is now coming up with excuses saying that he was picked on because of his accent and so on. But I mean, this is a guy who failed to investigate News International and then took the Murdoch coin by becoming a columnist for them.
We got to be careful here. The public is riding with The Guardian this week because after they weren't interested in what we were doing, the News of the World rather, the News of the World was doing to politicians or film stars or footballers, they got excited, of course, about the Dowler case and the other awful things which have since come out when the dam broke. But if you go back to this period, I don't know why Andy Heyman and the anti-terrorist squad feel the need to grab all the big cases and get the glory, because they then turn around and say, well, we didn't have time to investigate properly. We're dealing with terrorism, you know. And the context of quite a lot of what happened here is that they were meant to be dealing with terrorism, and they did regard this as a distraction. And we all know, if the voters had to choose what they thought was more important, they tick the terrorism box every time. Now, that's a critique of police management, but it's also a reminder that we mustn't step out of step with public opinion too.
That's an interesting point. Public opinion sort of shifted pretty quickly to get interested in this. Do you think when we've got this judge-led investigation we've all been calling for, that public opinion might have ceased to care by the time it gets around to reporting?
I'm optimistic that actually real seriousness of what has happened has kind of come to be understood now, in the same way that although the Hutton inquiry is much reviled, it nonetheless did expose something deeply unsatisfactory about the nature of government in the Blair years. The reason, Mike, why I say this is a different kind of challenge to the euro crisis, which of course is huge and terrible, is that this is a challenge actually to the way our democracy works, which is a subject everyone finds incredibly boring and nobody thinks is important. And now I think the relationship between politicians and the press and the police has been brought out into the public eye, and people can see what happens when it breaks down.
Mike, can I just ask you, finally, before we turn to Labour and Ed Miliband, about the dynamics of the coalition here? We've got Nick Clegg, I think, on his feet as we speak, making a speech which sort of disowns any responsibility for the Downing Street operation, and he's making very plain that this is something he disagreed with Cameron all along about. I mean, is the cracking in the coalition even more stark here than it was with Health?
It's a difficult day. Coalitions are like this. We don't have much experience of them. Clegg is entitled to say this was nothing to do with me, Gov, which he certainly wasn't entitled to say about the disaster of the health bill. He signed off on it. But you learn. And he's had a very high learning curve in a job he didn't expect to get a year ago. You can say that in spades. I haven't read the speech which Clegg's making today, but as long as he's not too priggish and not too self-righteous or guilty of sort of cheap party points, then too gloating, then, you know, the public will clock it in his favour. He said on the radio this morning, rather charming self-deprecation, that, the Lib Dems weren't in bed with the Murdoch people because Murdochs weren't very interested in getting under the duvet with the hopeless old Lib Dems until very recently. So, as it were, they're in the clear by default. It's just that nobody fancied them.
So, for the first time in a long time on Politics Weekly, we're sort of scenting a slight opportunity here for the Liberal Democrats. But what about Labour? Now, we heard earlier in the programme Ed Miliband applying pressure on the government over this. James, there have been some who doubted that the Labour leader had the guts to make the break and call for a Rebecca Brooks head a week ago, but he did it. Were you surprised?
I was surprised, actually, because I thought that he was surrounded by cynical figures who were persuading him against his own instincts to fall in line with the New Labour approach to Murdoch. And I was impressed because for two reasons. One, historical, which is that his past two predecessors, Blair and Brown, desperately tried to court Murdoch based on this myth that Murdoch determines election results, which he doesn't. He's just a businessman who backs the winner. And I think Ed was always detached from that and worried about it during those years. But I feared that he was in a position of weakness in recent weeks, which he was. But he has managed, I have to say, brilliantly to turn around his leadership by breaking the shackles both of Blair, Brown and that culture. And I think one or two people around him who urged caution on this.
Because one of the sort of concluding thoughts of your very enjoyable new biography of Ed Miliband is that it's too early to say which way this guy's going to go, you know, and you're saying if he surrounded himself with the forces of caution. This week people were talking about a Sodet moment, weren't they? That was the
That's right. And I think he has to, we say at the end of the book, and I do think it's true still, he has to decide whether he is going to be an insurgent in the way that he ran for the leadership and be distinct from, say, his brother David Miliband, thus justifying the family trauma that he's caused, or fall into what is called the centre. I think he's gone some way of deciding that he will be, for want of less priggish word, progressive leader, and moved slightly to the left. And I think that there may be an appetite for that. This may be the social democratic moment. It may be the only way he can win.
And do you think, because of course your book is really about both the Milibands, do you think we can say fairly emphatically David would not have done that last Wednesday?
That is a key and fascinating question for us Labour Kremlinologists, Tom. I suspect he probably would have triangulated on this one. I think he would have been very bold in other ways, but I think actually neither him nor Ed Balls, it should be said, would have been as bold as Ed Miliband has in the past week or so.
Mike, do you share this?
That's a very attractive scenario which James McIntyre has set up there. I'm not sure whether you win by moving to the left, but hey, you give it a shot. Nothing to lose at the moment, but it would be nice to think so. I have to stress that
the world has changed, Mike, as Ed Miliband told Cameron on Wednesday. The world has changed.
Yeah, I'm afraid, you know what us old Fartonians say, it has changed less than everybody thinks it has this week. It always does change less. You know, the Arab Spring is now the Arab Summer, and it doesn't quite look the same, does it? I would only make the obvious point that for a Labour leader to put the boot in into the Murdoch empire after years of sullen repression on the subject, you know, he did very well, Miliband. He's handled himself well. He's looked like a leader. He's been ahead of the curve. Nonetheless, it is, relatively speaking, one of the easier A-levels a Labour leader can sit, because it's all in the DNA. He has much more difficult challenges to face. It's been very enjoyable. Cathartic was the word Patrick Winter used in his Guardian report on page one this morning. I noticed the FT's George Parker used the same word. MPs, not just Labour, feel liberated from the tyrant. It's when the prisoners come out of jail in the last act of Beethoven's Fidelio, and they're having a good time. But real life resumes next week. week.
And regardless of how this plays with the public, Ed Miliband's certainly in command of his party in a way that he's not been until now. The question is, isn't it, can he move from running this anti-Murdoch insurgency into saying something more positive, selling something positive to the country?
The thing that James said that really kind of struck me is this business about him being able to speak to something he really believed. And perhaps for the first time, he's kind of had this kind of sodic moment of, and, you know, this is what I feel and this is what I'm going to say. The question is not whether he can do that with the party and continue to do it with on across a broader front, but whether he actually knows well enough what he thinks and therefore is in a position to fight this insurgency.
But do you think, James, I mean, I think on, I don't know, economics and regulation of the banks and all of that, he's kind of very aware of the half a need to defend the record, half a need to move on. Having succeeded this week by breaking free, do you think you could see him breaking free on a wider range of issues?
I do, I'm afraid, despite, I mean, I know Mike is doing well, rightly, at sort of pouring cold water at sort of some of my more fantastic ideas about Ed progressing now.
But no, it's warm water.
Okay, warm water.
Not cold.
Warm water, that's probably even worse. But Anne, I think, is right, which is he needs to discover what he's about, and this is part of that. I think, in a way, this might propel him into being, again, to use this slightly pious phrase, true to himself on things like regulation, which he always thought Labour was too soft on. You know, this is a guy who's always been torn. You know, on 90 days, he told backbenchers when he became an MP he thought it was crazy. He told Gordon Brown he thought it was crazy, but he voted for it. Iraq, he opposed it, but he wasn't then an MP, and he, you know, he kept his powder dry. He's torn, and now this might just propel him into a more insurgent-type leadership.
What do you think, just in reading the public mood? I mean, it's a very interesting subject for us, especially here at the Guardian, because we've been obsessed with it when others weren't. It's not a kind of bread and butter issue, and which might become more important by the time of the election. Do you think that the public will have noticed that Ed Miliband's performing very differently now, or do you think they'll still just know him as the guy who knifed his brother?
I think this may be, that's a very good question. I think this may be, although it is a nerdy subject, the first thing that he has cut through to the public on since knifing his brother. And that, there is still a problem over David. But I do think that they will recognise Ed Miliband's, you know, been leading the campaign after. And they recognise stories like Millie Dowler. I mean, I think just a slightly subtler thing, which is that the decline of the Murdoch influence is good news for progressive politics in this country and might free up the electorate. Because in under our ridiculous first-past-the-post system, people in marginal seats tend to be influenced by these papers, and that may be, you know, the decline of Murdoch means that Labour may do better, to put it crudely.
Mike, what do you think? Or is the Daily Mail just going to snap up all the market share?
Well, we don't know what's going to happen. There's a real fear that if Murdoch were to sell his British titles, there would be a further twist in the downward spiral of British newspapers. And I don't look to television to fill the gap. My God, or the internet. That's a scary scenario to my way of thinking. Again, you know, what James is saying is attractive. And I don't think the Mail would fill the gap if the Sun disappeared, let alone the Mail on Sunday and the News of the World. Different sorts of paper. There's quite a lot of long words in the Mail on Sunday. That sounds patronising. You know what? It's meant to be patronising. So, you know, it's a very fluid situation. Miliband made a breakthrough with the public. Well, it's better than nothing. It's a long haul.
Have we seen any polls yet? Have there been any polls in the last week?
Labour's been picking up on the polls in the last two. Since it went viral with Millie Dowler, I think am I not right, Anne? The Labour has gained from this, but that's all short term. So many more things are going to happen before voters get to put any crosses
which
in
is,
boxes.
Which is why it's so important that Miliband builds on this uses the momentum he's gained to tackle a wider and in lots of ways much, much more difficult range of...
It's about self-confidence too, isn't it? That you know, we all feel that. You have a good day, a footballer scores a goal, he's just scored a couple of goals. And that sort of gives you more confidence in yourself, more self-belief.
And in your team too. I think that's a really interesting point because...
And they've cheered him. They've cheered him in the chamber this week.
And a very kind of Westminster Village parish pump point, but he's just changed the rules, hasn't he, James, so that he can now hand-pick his own team in a way that he couldn't before. Do you think he'd be emboldened to bring in some very different faces?
I think he wants to bring in David Miliband, to go back to what we were talking about, but I don't think David will accept for now. But yes, he, as Mike and Anne have said, he will be confident because I think this was his, from what I gather, this was his decision, pretty much his decision alone in his inner circle, to really go on the offensive against Murdoch. It worked. He looks very happy and confident at the moment. And so I think, yes, he might well bring in figures. I mean, his shadow cabinet is pretty unsupportive. Historically, more people back David, and he might want some more people around him who are of his thinking on a lot of these things.
Picking young new MPs like Chuka Umunna and Rachel Reeves
and others.
I have to register that I was against that move. I think it shrinks the democratic space in the Labour Party and by extension in wider society, and we get too many quangos and too many appointments and too much patronage. We're all meant to be against it, and here we've now given an enormous chunk of patronage to this guy. You need people inside your tent who disagree with you. There's a famous story about President Kennedy after the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs, which he inherited in 1961 when I was a boy, and he then resolved to always have somebody around the table who took a different view, and also sometimes not to attend meetings so that different and divergent opinions could be expressed freely. And, you know, that's good doctrine, and it applies to newspaper offices and to businesses and to shadow cabinets too, says me.
I gather that in Australia, where Kevin Rudd got rid of equivalent rules, applied to the real cabinet and not just the shadow cabinet.
Well, it does apply to the cabinet. The Prime Minister does appoint the cabinet. That's the difference.
No. But in Australia, the Australian Labour Caucus, yeah, elects. Yeah.
Didn't do Kevin Rudd any good.
Well, no, that was my point. And I mean, were you sad to see that little bit of? Okay, it's insiders' democracy, but democracy nonetheless disappear?
I think much more important democratic levers have gone. And I think one of the things that I'd really like to see, and which in my kind of lovely little utopian world, I think might make a really significant difference, is if the parties, if Ed really does pursue this business about re-engaging with the party membership and expanding party membership and party support and working in communities, that it's building the party outside Westminster that matters, I think, more than the whether or not you elect the shadow cabinet.
And maybe some of those people will have taken heart this week. I mean, James, do you think now we can forget all the speculation there was even a few weeks ago? Or do you think it could come back? Do you think the Blairites are marginalised now?
It's a fascinating question. I mean, yes, I think he is strengthened certainly for the coming months. He goes into the party conference season pretty triumphantly, as opposed to what, you know, a week or so ago, people were saying it would be a make or break conference, as so many seem to be for Labour leaders. But I've always thought that actually his biggest threat is from Ed Balls, not the Blairites. I mean, the reality is that David being his brother, the Blairite threat is pretty neutralised. David isn't going to challenge him.
Do you think David will come back? Just before you...
I can't call that. I think if a pistol was held to my head, I'd say no.
Yeah, can he be subpoenaed by a select committee in order to come back? I really raise the question. As for Ed Balls, you know, Ed Balls, unless he takes himself apart like dismantling a car or a rifle and puts himself back together in a different form, he is unelectable even if he were the only candidate.
Just to clarify, clarify, Mike, I agree with that. I wasn't saying he's a credible candidate. I was saying that he remains restless and ambitious despite his loss.
And he's too brown-eyed and too tainted with Gordon. And as we saw from last night's extraordinary performance in the Commons by Gordon Brown, the ex-Prime Minister has whatever it is, the opposite of the Midas touch in these matters.
Yeah, I did think Brown's speech was opportunistic because he carefully painted over the fact that he desperately courted Murdoch and tried to be in with Murdoch and invited Rebecca Brooks for a slumber party at Chequers.
yeah, but hang on a minute. Those Labour politicians did stand up, and Brown was right about that in saying he resisted Murdoch on a number of points. And, you know, Blair blocked Blair's government on competition grounds. I looked it up this morning, 1998, blocked Murdoch from buying Manchester United.
But Blair changed... But Mike, Blair actually changed policy to suit Murdoch. Erwin Stelzer, Murdoch's aide, went into Downing Street and said, you need to reverse your policy on a referendum on the Constitution or we'll withdraw the support of the Sun and the Times. And Blair did it. Disgraceful.
Well, plenty of people listening would say, good for Erwin Alka-Seltzer. Not that we ever had that referendum, not that we needed. Events took care of that one.
Events now may be taking care of the Murdochs too. If everyone was fawning over them at one point, everyone's running a mile right now. We're going to leave them too just now. So my thanks to Anne Perkins, to James McIntyre and to Michael White. James's new biography of Ed Miliband, which is co-written with Mehdi Hassan, is published by Biteback and out now. The producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks for listening and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.